For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very, very happy to have as our guest speaker tonight Professor Paul Kopp, who many of you know from practicing here Monday evenings, but also he's a professor in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at University of Chicago, and a fine Buddhist scholar. And he's going to speak tonight about a topic that I find very interesting. It's a little esoteric, but he's going to talk about Dharani. So we just chanted one of those. There are many of them that are chanted in Zen and Mahayana, but they're not so frequently talked about in American Zen, but I think they have an important role in our practice. And Paul's specialist in Tang Dynasty, Chinese use of Dharani, which again may sound esoteric, but it's very exciting for me. So, Paul, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, of course. Hello. It's a real pleasure to have this chance to talk to you. It feels pretty presumptuous to be sitting right here and giving a talk, but I will muddle through anyway with a little scholar's dharma. So Dharanis, a few words on them tonight. Most often we encounter the Dharanis, and the word Dharani really, in the context where they refer to, let's just call them incantations, spells, such as the one that we just chanted, the Bucho Sonsho Dharani. I'll talk a little bit more about that one in particular a little bit later. But as Tygon said, it's true, I think, that you very rarely hear about them in Buddhism today, especially Buddhism in the West, I think, because they can sort of seem like, in many ways, maybe they seem like the most mysterious aspect of Buddhist practice, and mysterious just in the sense of you sort of look at them and you don't know really what they are, what they could mean. But they were really central to the practice of Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism, especially of all kinds, throughout history. And in Asia today, East Asia today, certainly still central. I mean, they're still chanted every day in all kinds of Buddhist monasteries around in Japan, in China and Korea, etc. So where to start? They first appear as incantations, if I can just use that word, in Mahayana Buddhism in a number of famous sutras, right? Very early Mahayana Buddhist sutras, most famously perhaps the Lotus Sutra, where one of the last chapters is entirely devoted to Dharanis. And in that context, the Buddha teaches the Dharanis to protect those who will chant and teach and spread the Lotus Sutra and its teachings, because at the time, of course, as the early Mahayana tradition was forming, Mahayana teachings were quite radical, and their understanding of the Buddha, for example, was not the one that most people were used to at that time. And so there's some sense, anyway, historians sort of take it as a clue that people didn't accept it and were sometimes maybe not entirely nice about in their non-acceptance. And so these spells were given to sort of protect those who were going to go around teaching the Lotus Sutra, not only from other people, but also from the dangers of the wilds, and protection from the dangers of the wilds, from snakes, etc. is one of the early uses of spells in Buddhism, and Dharanis as well. I think for us here, the one that we encounter most often is the short spell, sometimes called a mantra, sometimes called a Dharani. The text just says spell at the end of the Heart Sutra. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha. And the relationship between, I don't want to say too much about it, but we can talk about it later if you'd like. The relationship between that spell and its text, the Heart Sutra, is very interesting. One way of reading the sort of lead-in to the spell is that the spell itself is somehow the perfection of wisdom, is somehow the Prajnaparamita teachings, which is quite interesting. And this idea that a spell, right, a relatively short text, can somehow encompass something incredibly large, a large extent of the Buddhist teachings, for example, what's the perfection of wisdom literature, right, of which the Heart Sutra itself is the sort of boiled down essence. And then the spell, at least on one reading, is sort of the further boiled down essence of that. And the Prajnaparamita literature is just vast. There's the version 100,000 lines and 10,000 lines, etc., all the way down. And I think here we can see sort of what's going on sometimes in Dharani's their sort of logic of miniaturization at play. And then we have the perfection of wisdom literature, not in 100,000 lines, not in 10,000 lines, but in the syllable right? And so what is the text? Well, the entire text is right? Somehow is said to be in many a range of texts the sort of mother of all language, the mother of all sounds, and somehow contains all sounds in it, right? It just in the very beginning. And this logic of containing is very important piece of what's going on in Dharani's. The word Dharani is just a quick note on the top of the sheet, one side of it. It means basically something like to hold, to grasp, to contain, also to support. It's derived from the same Sanskrit root as the word dharma, for example. Mm-hmm. And so you can... it's not only... It's the activity of holding, as I'll talk about in a minute, but it's also something that holds, right? And so the syllable or a dharani somehow can contain in a very short extent, you know, the entirety in some texts of the Buddhist teachings. One scholar likens them to DNA codes in this way. Somehow they're just, you know, it's an apt analogy, I think. It's not always sure completely what he means, but somehow that there's just little codes of in the DNA can contain, of course, all life in some way. And so maybe Dharani, maybe that's a good way to understand Dharani. That's what Scott, anyway, his name is Ronald Davidson, argues in an article a few years ago. But originally, the term Dharani didn't refer to spells at all, right? It refers, it's hard to say kind of which comes first, but on one level, one of the earliest sets of texts, for example, the word Dharani is pretty clearly a quality of the bodhisattva, a quality of the Buddhist practitioner, but not just any bodhisattva, usually, at least as it's described in these sutras, but of the so-called great being bodhisattvas, the bodhisattva mahasattvas, the ones like Manjushri, who we have here, or Guanyin, who are Samantabhadra, who are said to be the most far advanced. And what are the qualities of these mahasattva bodhisattvas? Well, they have samadhi, right? These levels of meditation, consciousness, really, it often seems like. A few others, let's not go into them all, but also dharani, right? And it's clear in these, at least I think anyway, in these texts that it's not referring to spells. It's not like, these bodhisattvas, they know lots of spells. I'm sure they do. But in these passages, it's not referring to that. It's referring to a quality, something like samadhi, right? And samadhi is actually often associated with dharani. And this idea of getting sort of the root meaning of the term dharani as hold or as grasp is a way, helps us to understand what that quality is, right? And there's a text called the Bodhisattva Bhumi, or the stages of the Bodhisattva, or the Bodhisattva stage. It's translated different ways, and it talks about dharani, four different kinds of dharanis, or four different levels of dharani, or four different ways of understanding it. It's people understand this passage differently. And the first one refers to memory. The ability of the bodhisattva to hold, right, refers to his or her ability to remember things, right? In the text, it refers to the fact, the sort of astounding ability, right? That the Bodhisattva Mahasattva remembers the entirety of the Buddhist teachings, every sutra, the whole thing, right? They have them memorized. This is Dharani level number one. Dharani level number two in this text, which is it's one of the earliest texts to sort of set out what the Mahayana path is. Number two is the Bodhisattva Dharanis, in a sense, the full extent of the teachings, but their meaning. Meaning that she understands them, right? That somehow, number one, right, you memorize the whole thing. You have all the text in your head or wherever it is. Number two, you remember it. Number two, you understand it, right? So if number one is holding in the sense of keeping it all in there somewhere, number two is more like grasp. I think the English word grasp is very helpful. Also means to hold, of course. But for us, it can mean to understand, right? You grasp something, you get it, right? So the Bodhisattva Mahasattva gets the teachings, right? Grasps the teachings in that sense. The third one in the Bodhisattva Bhumi is an interesting one. It's the Bodhisattva has these, it's called mantra dharani, right? Or spell dharani. And I'll tell you what I think it means. I think it means that the Bodhisattva Dharanis knows how to use, grasps these mantras, right? Mantras, spells, it refers to a particular kind of mantra, I think, in this early text. I'll come back to that in a minute, what those might be. But it's very clear in the text that this grasp of these mantras gets one to number four, which is Dharani as kshanti, right? Dharani as patient acceptance, the perfection of patience, right? The perfection of tolerance. Not sure what the house translation is of kshanti.
Patience, tolerance.
Patience, acceptance, and particularly the highest level, or the most sort of the perfection of kshanti in this case, which is often called the patient acceptance of the unarisenness or emptiness of phenomena, right? Of dharmas, of all things.
Anupatika dharma kshanti.
Anupatika dharma kshanti, right, very good. Also one of the few Sanskrit phrases I know. I can confirm that one. Meaning, as I understand this, that when one sees that everything is empty, right? That all things are unarisen, all things have no self. This can sort of be, I think, at least for the likes of me, a sort of a freak out moment, right? I mean, it's very hard to sort of deal with that. It's like that nothing's really there in the way that you thought it was, and the way that you sort of needed it to be. So the patient acceptance of that is to be able to, in a sense, contain it, right? And I'm trying to, fade in the language of Dharani, because in the Bodhisattva Bhumi and other texts, these things are equated in a way, or at least very closely associated with each other. So the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Dharanis him or herself in a way, right? Or Dharanis all things, grasps all things in their nature that is unarisen or empty. Able to keep hold of himself, however paradoxical that ends up seeming, under the doctrine of emptiness. So this is one stream, early stream of what Dharani means, these four kinds, this quality of the Bodhisattva understood in four different ways. We have these genre of text in Buddhism, and only in Mahayana Buddhism really, called the Dharani scripture, right? Or the Dharani sutra. And later, well, not so later, but really starting around 400 or so. That's not so late, I guess. My world is very late. But before that, the early Dharani scriptures, the Dharanis in them are not spells such as the Bucho Soncho Dharani, which we just chanted. I will get to them soon. But in one case, I think it's in the Bodhisattva Bhumi, I've forgotten, they refer to these literally nonsensical strings of syllables. And the practitioner is supposed to take these, it's supposed to write them down, which is interesting, and go off into the woods, go off into, it says, into the sort of desolate wilds, or it mentions swamps, anyway, far away from other people, and contemplate these nonsensical runs of syllables, which is pretty interesting. And as the text says, that in the contemplation of these nonsense, right, and it's important that it's nonsense in this case, somehow you are supposed to see that, well, it's not just that there's no sense, syntax, grammar, whatever here in this sentence or non-sentence, it's that in fact all things are like that. So somehow it's a way to understand the emptiness of things, the unarisenness of things, in a particular sense, the sort of nonsense of things. This is one early kind of Dharani as a text. There's another very early sort of non-spell sort of Dharani. It's like a code. Code in the sense of A is for apple, you know, B is for banana, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it is to help in the memorization of mnemonic devices to help one in the memorization of Buddhist doctrines. There are a few early texts. Dharani text is one called the Anantamukha, or the sort of the infinite doorway, I guess, whose Dharani in the early versions of those texts is one of these. A is for apple. You know, it uses the famous mantra that goes Arapachana, which is the beginning of one of the Sanskrit syllabaries, and that mantra gets associated in some texts with Manjushri, who we have there. So these are sort of early, but you know, if Dharanis as a whole are esoteric, those are the sort of esoteric of the esoteric. You know, you very rarely see those anymore, and they seem to have sort of fallen out of practice, really, in Buddhism, as far as I can tell, at a very early stage. So, for example, in this the Anantamukha Dharani scripture, the infinite doorway, later translations or later versions of it, the Dharani is no longer this sort of A is for apple kind of thing, but a spell. Something sort of similar to the Bucho Sancho again, which we just chanted. And what are those? I mean, those are the ones we will encounter most often. Well, just at a basic level, they are transliterated Sanskrit. Transliterated, not translated, meaning just they took the sounds of the Sanskrit and then someone a long time ago in China tried to find Chinese characters in the dialect of the time that sort of as closely matched as possible the sound of the Sanskrit. And then that is sort of, those characters in most cases are taken as canonical, they get pronounced in Japanese, which we just did, or in Korean, or in what have you. Many texts that talk about Dharanis, these kinds of Dharanis, emphasize that you should not translate them. Or if you can translate them, to sort of try to understand them, I'll talk about that. But when you chant them, you must only chant the sounds. You must get the sounds right. Right? This draws on a very ancient idea of coming from India, that Sanskrit itself is somehow encodes, you know, something very essential to the nature of the universe. Especially these things called seed syllables, like om or in some cases. There is a... make sure I don't miss too much here. That's not to say that there weren't translations, though, and it's useful to look at these, or glosses, really, or discussions of the meaning of these kinds of dharanis, because they certainly did have meaning. And if you read Sanskrit, and you look at a dharani, you can see that, you know, it's kind of crazy Sanskrit in most cases, ungrammatical, the words are changed, mainly, probably, perhaps, and let me just, this is guess, I'm guessing, to make them sort of better to chant. But you can sort of make them out, you know, they do make sense in a way. And there are a few different kinds, if we look at them in terms of meaning, there are a few different kinds of dharanis on that level. The Bucho Sancho, according to this commentary from the 8th century that I spent a lot of time with, is it's a sort of two-part thing. On the one hand, it's a description of, it's a performative description, to use a sort of technical language, of light, of sound as light. By performative I mean that the describing actually makes it happen in a way, right? And the way that this monk named Fa Cheng a long time ago, 8th century, as I said, when he describes the action of this dharani, he focuses on one of the initial syllables, om. As he translates it, the text says, it begins with an invocation of the Buddha, as many texts do, and then it says in a classical mantra language, here's how it goes, or, this is what it says, om, right? He doesn't translate om. And then he describes what om does, and om is a sort of a burst of radiance, right? A burst of light, and which is sound too, sound as light, and the sort of synesthetic language imagery is very important in dharanis. That is where the senses sort of bleed into each other, sound as light, etc. And it's this burst of radiance is closely connected with, when you read, for example, Mahayana sutras, before the Buddha speaks, before he teaches, light comes out of him, right? Often it comes out of his mouth, sometimes it comes out of his sort of forehead, sometimes the top of his head, sometimes his feet in a couple of cases. And then it sort of circles around him, then it sort of illuminates the entirety of the cosmos, in some cases just lighting it up, in other cases actually purifying the cosmos. And then it comes back into him, and then he speaks. Very common occurrence in Mahayana sutras. So om, the burst of radiance at the beginning of this dharani, is described somewhat along those lines as a kind of consecration. So it moves throughout the world, and anybody who comes into contact with it, that is, hears it, but also somehow physically, gets in the way of it, that you are transformed, you are purified, all your ancient twisted karma is purified, is taken away. This is an important thing in the language of dharanis. Anyway, it goes on. Another part of the text, interspersed with that are something close to prayers. Prayers to the Buddha. May this happen, may that happen, may all beings have this or that. That's one kind of dharani. Another kind is closer to what we might think of as a spell, as a magical spell. The dharani in what's called the Pseudo-Sharangama Sutra, the Lungyan Jing, one of a very important scripture in East Asian Buddhism, has a mantra, has a dharani in it, excuse me. And that one's more like a spell in the sense of, it summons good guys who will defeat the bad guys, basically, or it invokes the bad guys, demons, and says that they will all be crushed and destroyed. This is, and when I say this is what the dharani of the Sharangama Sutra, not the Sharangama Samadhi, but this other one, when I say that that's what it says, I'm simply following what some Tang Dynasty glosses on the scripture, on the spell said. We're doing it for time here.
We're okay. It's only 8:20.
Okay. So those are, that's a quick, sort of quick overview of what the spoken dharanis are, things like the Bucho Sonsho. What does Bucho Sonsho mean, you may ask yourself? That part is actually not a transliteration, that's a translation. The Bucho is the Ushnisha, right? The bump, you can see on the top of the Buddha's head, which in some texts, some traditions, is sort of if a dharani is in a way the essence of the Buddha's teachings, contains everything in its sort of most intense form, the Ushnisha in some descriptions is, this is the most intense part of the Buddha's body, right? The most intense concentration of, of Buddha-ness, I guess. So the Bucho Sonsho. Sonsho is, it means, originally it's a translation of the Sanskrit word vijaya, which means basically to be victorious. The word that was chosen to translate it in Chinese, zunsheng, Japanese sonsho, doesn't mean so much victorious, it means more like glorious or wonderful or superlative or amazing, something like that. So it's the glorious Ushnisha of the Buddha, Dharani, or as I translate it, the Dharani of the glorious Buddha's crown, something like that. If you want to understand crown in this sort of in a looser sense. I'll come back yet again to the Butcho Sonsho, but now if we can look at some pictures. Now here's another sort of esoteric stuff, but I'm sort of taken with it all. In the Tang Dynasty in China, the years 618 to 907, those of you who are keeping track, but really all the way through the 10th century or so, for these particular ones, in the case, more generally speaking, of people writing down dharanis and then wearing them as amulets, this still goes on today. But these particular cases, the ones I'm showing here, are, as far as I know, no longer in use, but they're very fascinating. This is a different dharani, not the Butcho Sonsho, but not sure the Japanese of it actually, but the Sanskrit is the Mahapratisara, which means something like wish fulfillment, right? Pratisara is an amulet, means amulet. Again, the Chinese, it's Dai Tsui Guru Dharani, maybe the Japanese, but it means something like the great amulet or the great wish fulfiller, something like that. We have two, well, the first case, the first picture, I mean this one here, is an amulet of this particular Dharani. So we have a sort of tripart visual structure there. At the center, we have an image of a bodhisattva, or another kind of deity, Buddhist deity, with his or her hand. Sometimes it's clearly female, sometimes it's not. Over the top of the head of an image of a practitioner who is bowing down before this figure. This is what this Dharani scripture says you should, when you want to make one of these amulets, this is what you should put in the middle. Again, we see this sort of logic of consecration, right? As I said, in the Butcho Sonsho, the way it's described, the light as sound, or sound as light, I guess, goes out and purifies the world. In this case, the wearing of the Dharani on your body does the same thing. And here we have an image of how that works, right, of this bodhisattva, or in some cases it's not a bodhisattva, it's a sort of a divine being doing the same. Here it looks like they're holding a vajra, so some kind of a vajrapani, vajradhara figure. Then in the middle we have the text spiraling outwards in Sanskrit script. Sometimes they're round, sometimes they're square like this one. I like to imagine it as sort of, you know, the spiraling sound of the spell going outward and again filling the cosmos, at least in our imaginations here, an image of that. And then around the outside we have a bunch of ritual objects, the sorts of things that one would have seen in Dharani rituals let's call it the 8th, 9th century in China. The sorts of things, not exactly tantric or esoteric Buddhism, but the same sorts of things that you would have found in those kinds of rituals. So in a way, it's an image really of the ritual, of the Dharani recitation, right, which would have been done as it would have been done in a sacred space, not unlike the one we are sitting in right now. And note that the ritual implements are all on fire, right? They're all blazing with potency. I take this to be a sign that the amulet, this piece of paper, is sort of alive with potencies, right? It's sort of on fire with dharanis. Here we have another one below it. A different spell is here associated with the Buddha Amitabha, Amida in Japanese. Has two names, really, Amitabha or Amitayus. Amitayus means infinite life. Amitabha means infinite light. Same guy. Just another one. How would these have been worn? Well, we have two pictures, right? They were folded, rolled up, put in these armlets, these arm rings, and then worn on the body here, usually on the right arm. How do we know that? Well, we found them. These were found in tombs. Buddhists were buried with them. We don't know if they were just put on them after they were dead, or if this was their amulet they had worn in life. Unfortunately, we don't know. But anyway, I'm pretty taken with these guys. Happy to talk more about them afterward. But returning to our Bucho Sonsho, I don't know that it's used this way anymore, but again, in 8th, 9th, 10th century in China, we know that it was used in funerary practices as a way to care for the dead. So we have a painting here. This is from a detail of a painting from Cave 217 at Dunhuang, a place in northwest China. If you can get there, I encourage you to go, where they are doing what the scripture tells them to do, and that is to take, we have a dead body here, laying down, and you are to take some dirt or some dust or some ash or some oil or some water, hold it in your hand, speak the spell into the medium, and then sprinkle it onto the corpse, right? And then that will affect the rebirth, well, wherever this person is now, hell, heaven, well, not a heaven, he wouldn't have to do this for him. Presumably they're in some place that they don't want to be, or you don't want them to be, and so you enchant, literally, right, enchant the dirt, you spread it on the corpse, and then that will sort of change the karmic direction of the afterlife direction of the person. And there are lots of stories in East Asian Buddhism of these things working, right? You know, you chant it, you do this, and then suddenly, you know, the person who may have, usually is a relative, your mother or your father, appears in the sky sort of trailing glory and saying, thanks. Well done, that worked. In Japan, another spell called the Komyo Shingon, or the mantra of light, sort of is the most famously used in these sorts of practices. But at least in this time in China, it was the Bucho Sonsho. We found a number of these urns, funeral urns, where the ashes of the dead were put into them. And then you can't see it here at all, but the Dharani is inscribed around onto the face of the jar here. Same difference, right, as we used to say. That somehow it's the logic of contact with the spell, right? Being in actual contact, whether with the spoken tones or here with the written version, you know, has the same effect. It transforms you, does good things for you. On the back, we have two of the more famous versions of these. You see these, if you go traveling in China and you go to old temple sites, you will certainly see these things. They're just simply everywhere. They're called Dharani pillars. The one on top is, you won't see that unless you go to New Jersey. That's in New Jersey at the Princeton University Art Gallery. But this one below it here is actually out in the world. Oh, I guess Princeton's the world. They don't always like to. Don't tell them I said that. And we put, I'm sorry, here it is, on Utaishan, which is a very famous mountain sacred to Buddhism. Again, also, it's where Manjushri was said to live. Maybe he still lives there, I don't know, in China. Here is a very famous one, or, you know, famous in my world. And in three registers, we would have the, on the bottom, typically we would have a description. This pillar was made for so-and-so, for a certain person, so that they would benefit from it especially. Then we have usually a citation or a quotation of the Dharani scripture, you know, extolling the wonders of the spell. And then the spell itself, inscribed here, I can't remember where it is, but probably on the top, and some other images in there for good measure. So that's a quick tour, anyway, of some of the world of Dharanis. As I said, just to really emphasize, it's not just, I sort of, you know, I'm pretty taken with these things, and I do love them, but they are very important, and certainly if you travel in Japan or China and stop in at Buddhist temples, Zen temples, any kind of temple, I think, you will certainly hear Dharanis chanted as we just did only moments ago. So anyway, I would, you know, attacks, questions, whatever. I'm very happy to try to answer them.
Thank you very much, Paul. Just
to add a couple things.
Yeah.
That even though in most American Zen you don't hear about Dharanis, some places like ours we chant them, but it's very much part of modern Japanese Soto Zen as well as other forms of Japanese, Korean, Chinese Buddhism today. Just as, for example, we have in our chant book, and we haven't chanted it very much, the Daishin Dharani, the Shosan Yokichijo Dharani, and any of you who've been to our Sagaki ceremonies for feeding the hungry ghosts around Halloween time, there's a whole series of Dharani, and I wanted to mention that particularly because it talks about their function. It's in the chant book on 30 and 31. I don't know if you want to comment on this, but there's a Dharani for arousing Bodhi mind, there's a Dharani for summoning deceased spirits to the great assembly, for opening for receiving the three-stick bodhisattva precepts, there's one for opening the throat of hungry ghosts, opening a passageway through the gate of hell. My question is, it seems like there's a whole different range of how Dharani has been used, but there seems to also be this idea of some function of it, and maybe that's the incantation aspect. So I just wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, thank you. Dharani's mantras, they are derived from, I think, at least one of the sort of streams that feeds the tradition, their tradition, is simply the tradition of spells. And some of the very earliest Dharani sutras, some of them are extremely short. There's one that's for the ease of toothache. So there are dharanis for that, for headaches, for all kinds of things. There are even dharanis too that are sort of love spells in a way, although they get sort of turned or changed slightly in Buddhist texts, so it's if the arising of the compassionate mind is derived from a love spell. I'm not saying that would be interesting. But you do sort of one angle into that subject is that, right? That it comes from this very old tradition in India and elsewhere of spells for particular purposes. Dharanis are very closely, and mantras too. And let me say that although in sort of textbook Buddhism you will see that dharanis are like this, mantras are like that, they're not the same. For over 1,000 years, really, in East Asian Buddhism, that this difference has been sort of elided. And the word jo or chu in Japanese spell is used for both of them. But both of them are very closely connected with the feeding of hungry ghosts. Hungry ghosts, as we know, they can't eat anything except for something that's called amrita, right? Or ambrosia, right? Or sweet dew. And the Bucho Sonsho Dharani, it says that it is sweet dew, actually. It says that the sort of substance of the spell is sweet dew. And in many rituals for the feeding of hungry ghosts, the sweet dew that you feed them is, in fact, dharanis, or spells, or mantras. It's the dharma. It's the sounds of the dharma being spoken. I think there was another part of the question I forgot.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Okay.
So probably other people have comments or questions.
Well, it seems like dharanis, when they appeared, were a big change from what had been prior religious practice, because in Indian yogic traditions, you were discouraged from writing down mantras.
Yeah.
And even the Vedas were never written down until something like the 16th or 17th century. And even in esoteric Buddhism, if you read a tantra, the mantras will be written out, but they're not effective until you have the initiation and your teacher pronounces them and you pronounce them afterwards. So you just reading them, just written mantras aren't effective.
Yeah.
And that's different from Dharani and maybe the East Asian tradition.
Right, that's a very good point. Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, but, right, that's the answer, right? Officially, that's true. And this is, in fact, why I got very excited in grad school a long time ago about these things, especially. These pillars are what first sort of piqued my interest for exactly this reason, because we know, right, and in many traditions still today, mantras, dharanis, they have to be spoken exactly right, right? And they have to be spoken because it's the sound. And sometimes they have to be spoken only after the proper initiations, right? By the right people in the right contexts. Yes, and yet, you know, you find these amulets, let's just say dharanis, potent in, or the idea that dharanis are effective in their written form everywhere. And at first I thought maybe this was a sort of East Asian change to the tradition. I mean, there's an old cliche, really, about, well, India is about the spoken word and China is about the written word, right? You know, leaving that alone, I've found more and more that scholars of Indian stuff will say, no, people were writing down mantras and wearing them, you know, from an early time, or at least treating them as efficacious in their written form, you know, from a pretty early period. So there's always a split, really, between what we might, what we might call textbook doctrine, right? And you can call it popular, or let's just say the way, you know, people have actually practiced or understood things, you know, across history and across cultures. You will still find, you know, it's very much true, though, that in certain forms of esoteric Buddhism, tantric Buddhism, I mean, what you said is exactly right. I mean, you write them down, it's nothing, you know. But there is a very old tradition, and thriving even today, of things like these. Amulets, pillars, talismanic uses of written dharanis. Someday soon, I hope this book will reach your bookstore, your local bookstore, which is about this very subject. I don't know, I despair of that ever happening, but...
Well, there's supposedly, at least I've heard that there are now sort of mantra manuals, where there have been for the last 100 years of India.
Yeah.
So that it's all written down, you need a mantra to practice with, you go look it up in the book, which would have... It's pretty new culturally in India, even if there were spells that were written down for magical forces.
I think of it as a sub-tradition, I mean, an ancient and an exalted sub-tradition, to be sure, of secrecy, right? Mm-hmm. And not just secrecy, I don't want to say for secrecy's sake, but, you know, that, you know, this is powerful stuff, and we have to make sure, you know, that people are ready for it before they do it. But then, you know, dharani pillars are to be written, are to be put on these things, and then, you know, put in crossroads, you know, put in the door, in the entranceways, to temples where you'll find them today, put on high mountaintops, you know, the absolute opposite of secrecy.
Could that be linked in a way to just Mahayana attitudes to try to disarm the Dharma?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
And speaking of entryways, there's a Tibetan version, Tibetan writing of the Buddha's crown, or Victoria's head top, dharani is one translation I've seen, which is over the door coming from the kitchen into the zendo. You may notice it in Tibetan. But there's a couple of other hands. Nyo-san first.
Yeah, and maybe Paul, or maybe you have something to say too, Dagan. You know, in contemporary Buddhism, say in Soto Zen, North America, are there, so far as you know, any other ways that dharani are practiced with other than, as we did tonight, with simply chanting? For example, Taigen, is there a tradition of dharani being passed from teachers to students in a more sort of ritualized kind of way? Is there a tradition of monks, you know, partaking in sort of omelets, kind of thing, or has it evolved to what we've had here tonight?
I don't know.
Well, I'll say a little bit. The aspect that Paul was talking about consecration, is very much part of modern American as well as Japanese Soto Zen transmission ceremony, and even ordination ceremony, and even lay ordination ceremonies. So when I do the wisdom water blessing at lay ordination and priest ordination ceremonies, there are particular dharanis that I'm saying that is part of that. So yes, it's part. It's there. It's the other side of that, though, and this is maybe heretical on my part, but I, as I've said numbers of times, many of you have heard me say it, that you're welcome to, in the middle of practicing zazen, of just sitting, to use a mantra or dharani as a way of focusing and settling. And I do that myself sometimes, and also walking around. I find dharanis and mantras very helpful in focusing and settling myself, and so I've invited you all to do that. And again, I don't know how heretical that is in American Soto Zen, but it's part of our tradition. So that's my response. I don't know if you have any comments.
That's interesting.
And just to note that the Komyo Shingon that you mentioned was promoted by a contemporary of Dogen, Myoe, who was a Shingon and Kegon monk. So, Tom, you had a comment?
Yeah, you mentioned the need for absolute accuracy of pronunciation. That they're reading these things in characters moving around in China, so they would be coming out differently.
Chinese and Sanskrit are as different from each other as you can get.
Dialects.
Well, even there is certainly the idea that the correct pronunciation is important. It's also true, I think this is now changing, at least I've seen examples of it changing in say China and Taiwan. But for a very long time, you know, they didn't really try, they didn't... The characters, in a sense, became the holder of the efficacy, right? Rather than the sounds.
Okay.
And so, say, translations done by people like Kumara Jivar, these very famous translators from Chinese Buddhist history, as far as I know, nobody changed them. I mean, that... although, you know, you would... On one level, you would certainly want to try to get, you know, you would want, A, you would want to learn Sanskrit, right? Or B, you would want to, you know, adjust the Chinese to your particular dialect to get as close as you can to the original form. That rarely happened, as far as I know. In fact, it almost never happened. I think today you see people learning, chanting them as we do, saying gate, gate, panagate, which is Sanskrit, right? Not chanting, say, the Japanese... the Sino-Japanese transliteration of gate, gate, paragate. That's my limited experience, that seems to be happening.
So they actually learned yet a different pronunciation for a particular character than their own dialect.
I mean, some... in Taiwan, for example, where I know a little bit, there are sort of two basic languages, Chinese languages, Taiwanese, it's a southern dialect, Mandarin, a northern one. In many temples, they will chant these characters in Taiwanese, right? In others, they will chant them in Mandarin. But again, as far as I know, nobody's looking for new characters to try to sort of get back to that.
And to further complicate it, what we chanted tonight is Sino-Japanese, which is a little different from the Chinese. But one point, and I wonder what you think of this, is that these not original Sanskrit, but Sino-Japanese sounds like Bucho Sunsho Dharani or Daishin Dharani have been chanted for many, many centuries in Japan that way. And just, you know, would the use of it in a slightly different form from the Sanskrit over time have any particular impact? I don't know. What do you think about?
I don't understand.
Well, just that there's this ancient tradition of chanting a Dharani in a Sino-Japanese version, for example, which is different from the Chinese, different from the Sanskrit, slightly.
Sure. I mean, there's, in many ways, you know, sort of tradition, right, is where, at least the, I'm here, I'm just making this up, saying what I think, you know, is where the feeling of efficacy and connection comes from, right, and chanting something different. I mean, gate, gate, you can chant it in modern Mandarin, it's jiedi, jiedi, right? And that, if you are used to chanting jiedi, jiedi, and someone says gate, gate, you know, it's like, that, you know, we... Anyway.
We're going a little bit over our usual time just because we have this wonderful opportunity of having Paul speak to us, but well, let's go a little further. Brooks.
I just had a question about, you know, just the objects, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine what an armband is, so like about what size that might be, but I was curious, like this first picture.
Oh, good.
I think I heard you say that maybe it was placed into that, like about how large, like what is this like?
The sheets are all different sizes. They're about like this big, mm-hmm. the ones I've seen. But they're folded and then rolled up.
Paper or?
These are both paper. They're, the earliest ones are silk. Silk was simply easier to come by than paper in many times.
So Tibetan prayer flags that many of us have seen.
It's the same logic, right?
Are those Dharani also on those sometimes?
I guess. I don't know. I don't read Tibetan. But this idea of sort of, you know, the contact with the air or prayer wheels, it's the same kind of thing. It's this, if you think of it in terms of sort of ritual logics, it's very much the same thing. The Butchō Sonshō Dharani, as we can see from the printing block up there, it's also very important in Tibetan Buddhism. Slightly different tradition. Dharani is starting, at least in China, around 11th century. They become deities. They become female deities. Dharani is in the feminine form in Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. So they become goddesses, in a way. And you will see the Ushni Shivajaya Dharani goddess, and very often there are tanka paintings of her, very commonly in Tibetan Buddhism.
With the with the prayer wheels, like the Tibetan ones or whatever, so you can pick that up pretty much in any like Buddhist shop. So, but like with Dharanis, can you pick something like that up in any Buddhist
at this time? Or now, today? You mean today?
Yeah, like today. Tonight. Tomorrow morning.
Everybody wants to get their Dharani.
No, I'm just kind of curious because I was, for a minute there, I was getting confused and thinking like the prayer wheel that my dad had gotten was maybe Dharani, but it's not. It's Tibetan. So it's not going to be the same thing.
Dharanis are important in Tibetan Buddhism, of course.
But
often you will, you know, the Om Mani Padme Hum.
Yeah, I mean, that's his big thing, and that's kind of the big thing. But I was just curious if that was something that was here in the U.S.
I have not seen them. I mean, I've seen things like Om Mani Padme Hum on various things, mostly in Tibetan stores. Even in China, I don't know that I've seen anything like this today.
Because if you don't have to worry about chanting it or saying it correctly, and you could wear it or...
That's right. I mean, there's a ritual practice.
And it's all good, right?
Where you chant a sutra, but you just, instead of, I wish I had a book here I could show you, just go like, you just sort of flip through the pages, right? And that's that counts as a recitation of the entire book. I mean, you will see this pretty commonly. Same thing. There was a revolving bookcase in Buddhism where you have Buddhist books, like the ones back there, say, but put it around, and you sort of spin the bookcase around, and that counts. Because, you know, when you recite a sutra, that counts as producing the body of the Buddha, right? And the production of the body of the Buddha produces merits, right? Which helps us all in our with our karma problems, right? Or at least mine. I
mean, I have Chinese people actually give me amulets that have Heart Sutra enclosed in them. Is that sort of the same gizmo going on?
That would be my feeling.
Yeah, because there's usually like some kind of, you know, deity, Prajnaparamita, or somebody's written on the sutra, the sutra's all written and it's folded up.
Or you write it into the egg of the omelet, the omelet, which I didn't know about until earlier. Or maybe the only Chinese Buddhists are vegetarians, of course. Whatever the proper substitute would be.
But there's also many Tibetan Buddhist statues. I don't know if this happens in China, where there's some. Sometimes it's a Dharani that you can hear if you rattle it. You know.
The consecration, the enlivening of statues with texts, also happens in Japan and China. Sometimes you will put there's something called the verses on conditioned arising. The Praticca Samuppada Gatha, which is, again, like a Dharani, is supposed to sort of encompass the essence of the Buddhist teachings. Those were very commonly written on statues. So you can write them on them, you can put them inside, you can
range of things.
How about people's bodies? Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
I mean, it's getting a little far afield, but...
Tattoos.
Tattoos. I mean, I see a lot of tattoos in southern, Buddhist things. I'm just sort of wondering, is there ever been any...
Well, I think in Southeast Asian Buddhism you do that. Don't really quote me on that, but you see these tattoos that look like that. That's my guess.
Yeah.
I have looked long and hard, for evidence of tattooing of these things. There, I have found some Buddhist tattoos. I'm a historian, so we're talking about it a long time ago. But mostly of images, not of actual dharanis, mantras.
Jeremy?
I was going to ask about intention.
Yeah.
That's an
important question.
Because it seems like all our tongues are created differently, all our teeth are in different places, so pronunciation's probably not going to be the same for everyone.
Yeah.
And I feel like the intention of just going forth and...
Well, the question of intention in general for these things is extremely important, and if we find a split, just like a similar split that we had a moment ago, some texts say that you have to prepare yourself, you have to do purification, right? Sometimes you have to fast for X amount of time before you do this, and then you have to chant them with one mind, with a concentrated mind, a pure heart. Some texts, for example, the scripture of the Bhutcho Sancho Dharani says that if you happen to be walking by one of these things and the wind blows some dust off of this Dharani pillar right here onto you, then you get exactly the same benefits as if you had done all that other stuff. So you have it's a striking split, at least as I understand these things, in the literature, right, in the tradition. Some people are very, you have to have the... you have to have the initiations, you have to do the preparation, you have to have the proper intention. Some say no, not at all. They're just both there.
Yeah.
But there's important points I should have raised in the talk. But thank you.